chapter 6, we read these words, "If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and have pierced themselves with many a pang." Well, good morning and welcome to Real Truth for Today. I'm your host, Pastor Jeff Shreve, the pastor of First Baptist Church in Texarkana, Texas. And we're talking today about the love of money. 1 Timothy 6:10 seems to come into play in our world on a daily basis. People seemingly sell their souls for filthy lucre, for the love of money. And on Tuesday, those of us in the golfing community, the broader golfing community, those of us who love the PGA Tour and follow professional golfers, were shocked to find that the PGA announced that they were merging with the European Tour, not a bad thing there, and the LIV Tour, the Saudi-backed LIV Golf Tour. And some years now, since LIV has been around, the PGA has been saying that is a horrible organization. The Saudis are just trying to buy their way into the prestige and the history of golf. They have lots of money, and they're luring away all our players with huge contracts, $100 million contracts to play in their league. But as Phil Mickelson, one of the first ones that went to the LIV Tour, said, "Hey, these are scary guys. They will kill you if they don't like you." And he mentioned about Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post reporter who was killed by the Saudis. They are linked to 9/11 and the atrocities that took place on 9/11 that took the lives of thousands of Americans as the planes flew into the Pentagon and flew into the World Trade Center. So the big question, what do we make of this? How are we to process all of this? And it is a great privilege for me to welcome to the program today one of Texarkana's favorite sons, and that is pro golfing legend Bill Rogers. Bill was on the pro tour for 14 years, and in 1981, he was voted the PGA Player of the Year. He won four tournaments that year, including the coveted British Open Championship. And so, Bill, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's good to be with you. And let me start by saying the older I get, the better I used to be in reference to what was.
Well, I was watching some video of you winning the Open Championship in 1981, and you looked great.
Well, I appreciate it. It was not only wonderful to win that championship, but also, the community I supported and was raised in, Texarkana, it was great to share that with the folks at home. So it was a defining moment, certainly in my golf career.
Now, you moved to Texarkana when you were how old, Bill?
1963. Dad retired from the Air Force, and we moved to Texarkana. He had some great friends there who he had actually served in the Air Force with, and they kind of convinced him that Texarkana would be a nice place to land. And we packed up and moved.
And you started playing golf when you were how old?
Oh, 8 or 9. We were a golf family. Dad was a very good player, competed a lot, actually, in the Air Force and golf tournaments. My brother, Rick, who everybody in Texarkana is familiar with, is a big golf guy and a wonderful ambassador for the game of golf. And they were very influential in my beginnings in golf. Heck, I watched them. Caddied for him, shagged balls for him, followed him to the golf course, and just almost by watching and kind of being around it, I was able to pick it up pretty quickly.
How much older is Rick than you?
Rick would have been 77. He's 5 years was 5 years older than me. You know, we lost Rick a little over a year ago, and but he was a great golf guy for certain.
Yeah, and super guy. He gave me some tips maybe about 2 years ago. He was trying to teach me how to chip. Golf is a hard game for me, Bill. But
he was a giver. I think everybody loved that piece of his personality. He liked to give, liked to teach, and he's great person of the golf world for certain.
So, how old were you when you started beating older brother in golf?
Well, I'd honestly say I'm not sure I ever beat Rick. It seemed like I could beat most everybody else, but Rick had my number. So I would never claim to have beat him, but I certainly was challenged regularly by him. But he went off on his kind of in his direction and played high-level golf at Baylor University as an amateur, and I ended up years later at the University of Houston where I played my golf.
Yeah, now U of H back then, they were salty. A lot of big names came out of U of H golf.
Yeah, it was kind of a proving ground, and I really didn't have the credentials to go to school, certainly on a golf scholarship, but Dave Williams, the golf coach, gave me a wonderful gift of scholarship to come to U of H, and you know, that's kind of where I, Jerry Robison at Northridge Country Club had kind of formed me into a nice little young junior player, but kind of my next step in the college ranks was at U of H and kind of grew into a good player there.
Mm. Okay, you became a professional golfer in 1974. If Wikipedia is correct there, Bill, and then you retired from the tour in 1988 at a relatively young age of 37. What precipitated that?
Well, that's right. I mean, some would look at kind of a short-term career. However, when you fold in from junior golf to amateur golf to pro career, I'd spent a good 25 years at the game competitively, and has a pretty good stay as it relates to the PGA Tour. 14 years, that was certainly enough for me. It was, I'm not so sure it wasn't 2 years too long, to be honest with you. 1987 and 88 were kind of years of just going through the motions. But, you know, there were so many factors. We'd need a whole lot of time to unpack them all, but the fact of the matter was I was ready for a direction change. It was I'd grown tired of the tour. The flame went out, so to speak. I lost the desire to compete at that level, and and certainly there's a spiritual God aspect to all of this. I think his hand was firmly on my life, and kind of we moved off the tour, and I never really had a regret from leaving the PGA Tour and the world of professional golf either. So I think that was an affirmation from God that kind of a new chapter was going to begin and he was going to be involved.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bill, I think a lot of people from the outside looking in, they look at professional sports, especially a professional golfer, and they think, oh, what a great job, how exciting, how glamorous. But they don't see all the travel, all the time away from family. And back in the 80s, you didn't make these huge sums of money like they're making today. And so help us see what was life like for Bill Rogers in the 80s.
Well, relatively speaking, you know, of course, the more success you have, the more benefits. And obviously, there's financial reward to that. And heck, in your opening referencing, I guess, 1 Timothy 6 and the love of money, what have you, I'd be the first to admit I did love the almighty dollar, and that was a big focal point of my professional career. Of course, I was there to love the game, love to compete, but I did love the reward of, piling it on, and heck, I was kind of influenced by chasing the almighty dollar as a really an idol as it is. And but you know the tour was where I kind of made my living, and professional golf is more than just hitting a golf ball and trying to get it in the hole as quickly as possible. There's a whole lot to it. It's a profession. It's a lifestyle, and it's one that my wife and I bought into and loved. And you know, the long and short of it is, for the huge chunk of it, we enjoyed all that was involved in it. But there was a moment that we said, this is it's time to go home, raise our family, and like I said earlier, start a new chapter in our lives. But you know, I was some people would assess my career somewhat unique in that in 1975 I started the tour as a pure rookie, you know, at the very bottom of the heap, and 6 short years later I'm at the very top of the world in professional golf and having achieved quite a bit of success. And then 7 years after that I'm walking away from the professional game. So kind of an up and down and all around type snapshot look at my career. But you know, it has had about everything you know, in a life story that involves golf and, you know, family, the faith aspect, you know, it's been an all encompassing, important aspect of my life, for a lot of obvious reasons.
Well, what I love about golf, especially on a professional level, is, you kind of, you know, you eat what you kill. If you're not playing well, you don't, the way it was set up, you don't score, you don't get the big paycheck, and so if you're not making cuts, you're churning money, you're spending money, but you're not making money. Liv changed all that, where they were just giving these guys huge sums of money. And the other thing about golf has always been known as a gentleman's sport, as a sport of high integrity, high honesty. You know, lots of rules in golf. I mean, if the ball moves a quarter of an inch, you know, you're going to be assessed a stroke and stuff like that. But it seems like with this decision that was made by the PGA, this announcement on Tuesday, that they kind of threw their principles under the bus and said, well, we're going to go merge with the Saudi group because of financial reasons.
Yeah, boy, just a surprise to the golf world, no doubt, and especially those of us that have been so pro PGA Tour. In fact, you know, my livelihood was made on the PGA Tour, and I've thought about, you know, how to unpack this whole issue of what's going on. And you know, I was always felt like the PGA Tour was an untouchable entity. I've often described it as, you know, the purest of all sports for many of the reasons you just mentioned. A game of high, not that they all aren't, but golf has always seemed to represent the highest of integrity and honor. You know, it's... there's just so much inherent good with the game, not the least of which is it's a wonderful relational game. It is at a high level of popularity right now, and the fact of the matter is, professional golf and what happens in professional golf impacts every aspect of golf as a whole. Amateur golf, junior golf, it is a matter of fact. And the recent decisions of which, you know, have stunned the golf world. It certainly has me as a former tour player, a member of the PGA Tour, even today. It's just, again, trying to piece this all together. But
Shocking indeed. Bill, let me break in. We got to come up on a break. You're listening to Real Truth for Today, and I'm your host, Pastor Jeff Shreve. We're talking to golf PGA pro and champion Bill Rogers. We're talking about the PGA-LIV merger. Don't go away. Welcome back to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. We're talking to PGA Tour champion Bill Rogers. He won the British Open in 1981, and he was voted and earned the title of PGA Player of the Year in that same year as he won four tournaments. And we're talking about the love of money. It seems to be coming into play on a regular basis here in America and around the world. For the love of money, 1 Timothy 6:10, is a root of all sorts of evil. It's not money that is evil, but it's the love of it and the attitude we have toward it. And it's very easy to fall in love with money. That's why Jesus said, no man can serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. So with the announcement on Tuesday that the PGA Tour was going to merge with the Saudi-backed LIV Tour, many were left just dumbfounded how we could see that huge of a reversal. And Bill, for those of us that don't understand how the PGA Tour works, does the commissioner or the executive director, whatever they call him, Jay Monahan, does he have sole authority to just say we're going to do this, or does he have to get approval from the players?
No, he's accountable to a board, which is made up of players and independent directors. And it is my understanding, I wish I could explain it out succinctly and where everybody could understand it, but this is actually a proposal that will ultimately be voted on by the tour board, and it in fact is not an ink dried deal as of yet, but I don't know all the underpinnings of how it will work out, but apparently it looks as though, you know, the tour will be in partnership with this PIF group, or, you know, which is in fact the LIV group. And, you know, I think there are so many questions that are unanswered at the moment that we're all kind of standing by to see what is going to happen. But the fact of the matter is, it looks as though the tour's position from day one, when it was basically challenged by this LIV tour, the tour has somehow or another been compromised so that they are now in you know, some sort of agreement partnership with this PIF group, and everybody's going to stand by to see how it impacts the world of professional golf. And certainly the players, if you've heard any of them comment, are kind of in a state of flux. They do not know exactly how this whole thing is going to shake out. But I think you frame up this whole conversation certainly from a scriptural standpoint, but as it relates to this whole money aspect, financial aspect of the world of sport, you know, it appears that in a world that more appears to be better, that is now impact professional golf. Our precious entity of the PGA Tour, it is very much impacted them, and we just don't know how just yet it's all going to shake out.
Well, it's very disheartening to see that, because as we said in the first segment, golf seemed to be one of those sports that was just rooted in integrity, and
yep.
And then the prestige and the history and all that. I heard Jack Nicklaus in an interview, and he basically summed up the LIV Tour. This was probably 6 months ago. He said they offered him $100 million to be the CEO of the LIV Tour.
Yep.
And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he said, you know, that just because you have a lot of money, you can't buy the prestige that the PGA Tour has built over the last 100 years. You just can't buy Amen. Your way in. But it seems like they have bought their way in. And the phrase, Bill, every man has his price, I hate to think that's true, but it seems like it's proving to be true for the PGA.
Well, 100%. And you could really, your takeaway at the moment could very well be LIV wins, tour loses. And, you know, we could really unpack this thing and, you know, flesh it out and but gosh, I was listening in the intermission there at one of your commercials is speaking about being good stewards, and I can't imagine what if they could be comment on what's happening, you know, from the Hogans to Byron Nelsons to these people, the Bobby Jones, these people that built this beautiful game of competitive golf, professional golf, professional men's golf, what they might be thinking right now, because it's a new landscape and the prospects, we can only wait to see, but it looks like big finances, big money, and you know, they can say all the pretty words about growing the game and this, but this is a big deal in the world of professional golf and golf as a whole.
Now, somebody from your in your position and the stature that you had from yesteryear, do you still have contact with the PGA?
No, I'm a member, and, you know, I'm always proud to say, been a member for some, 50 years now or so, but there's no, although there are, you know, benefits from, having been a member for a certain period of time that I have that, you know, that really, you know, don't amount to anything other than, you know, I'm a proud member of the PGA Tour and have been happy to be that for many, many years. So, but there's no contact. I'm so far removed from having my finger on the pulse of what happens with, you know, the underpinnings of the tour, but certainly somewhat aware, obviously, of, you know, what goes on in the world of professional golf.
Let me switch gears on you, Bill. Just some golf questions that I have from your perspective. But when you were playing on the tour, if you were paired with a guy that you didn't like playing with, how did that affect your round?
Well, as a professional, and if you're going to move forward and have any reasonable thought of being successful, you deal with all kinds, and you learn to deal with the players you like to play with, the players you don't like to play with, and everything in between. That's a discipline, and you can rest assured in that realm of golf, professional golf, if you're going to allow people you don't like to play with impact what you do, then you probably won't be around very long.
How about if you're a big hitter on the tour and you're paired up with a bigger hitter? Do you think that gets a guy to where he's starting to swing a little harder?
Yeah, same exact answer. If you allow that to affect your game and how you play, then you may not last very long.
That yeah.
Seems like a simple answer, but it's the truth. You brought to the table what you've got, and if it is in fact to the PGA Tour, you figured out somehow how to play the game, and if somebody else, by the way they play, impacts how you play, then you probably are not as focused on your business as you should be.
Well, I think what makes golf so hard and different from other sports are kind of reactionary sports. So you play basketball, football, tennis, you're moving, you're not having to think as much as you just are getting in the flow and reacting. Golf,
right.
Everything is a strong mental process. And I was watching a clip that ESPN or somebody did on you, Bill, and you were talking about being four strokes up at the British Open in 1981, and you said that's an interesting position to be in going into Sunday because everybody expects you to win, and it's yours to lose, and that can really start playing on your mind. How did you mentally fight that off?
Well, I had a problem with that. I'd never, in fact, beginning the day, Sunday, I was five shots ahead, and quickly, as I played the first seven holes, I managed to allow that five shots to dwindle to now a one-shot lead. So I'd begun the day playing very defensively, and, you know, you mentally prepare yourself to want to play exactly like you had the previous 3 days, but that wasn't the case. And it was unfamiliar territory with me being in that position. But on the other hand, experience, having played the tour and had lots of ups and downs, I was qualified to handle the adversity that of losing almost the total five shot lead. So I was able to get my feet back under me and probably losing that lead, and in fact making a double bogey on the seventh hole that last day, was the very best thing that happened to me. It was a huge wake-up call. And a lot of times, rarely do you play around where there's not some sort of adversity or negative impact on the way you're playing. And sometimes that can be a very good thing, because it'll snap you back into a reality of you need to focus on more than just winning a golf tournament. You need to focus on the shot at hand. So anyway, there's a lot more to that, but maybe that's a little bit of the long and short of it.
Yeah. Now, do you still play very much, Bill?
A little bit. I love to play, just for fun. Heck, if you've got a six-man scramble, I'll come and play. I like I like that pressure level in the six-man scrambles. That's just right.
I didn't even think they had those. That's funny. So, so in the last 5 minutes that we have, tell us how Jesus became real in your life. How old were you, and what were the circumstances surrounding that?
Well, Jeff, I wasn't brought up in what would be called a Christian family. However, a wonderful, loving family. A lot of people in Texarkana knew my family and Air Force background. But the fact of the matter is, as a second-year player on the tour in 1976, I found myself in a tour Bible study at a Holiday Inn in Tallahassee, Florida. Heard the good news. Somebody gave their testimony. Heard the good news of Jesus Christ. Walked out in the parking lot and invited him into my life. Met the Lord, and boy, I was on fire for 2 weeks, and I quickly put God up on the shelf, and I was back to the lure of all the professional golf tour was about. And it was a faith moment, no doubt about it, but it really wasn't until I left the tour in 1988 that I began what I call a kind of a committed faith journey. And involved in that were a lot of important people God placed in my life at that very moment, not the least of which was my wife, Beth. She had been brought up in Columbus, Georgia, in the Methodist Church, and we began to attend church, get our kids in Sunday school, and the beginnings of a faith journey. And like I said, important people involving me in fellowship and studying the Bible study fellowship, and just really understanding that God had given me a platform of golf to share my story and the good news of forgiveness and hope and joy and peace. And but that sometimes I think that might paint too perfect of a picture. Man, I'm still a work in progress. When I left that PGA tour, I was broken, and as I described, kind of a lost ball in the high weeds. But God had his way with me, and boy, it's been a wonderful adventure. I've had a great privilege of once again traveling almost all around the world in a different posture, and that is sharing the good news of Jesus. And so to him alone be all the glory, and we march on.
Amen. Amen. That's great. Now, do you come to Texarkana very often?
I should get up there more than I do. It's been a while. My intentions are to be there soon and see all my all my buds and spend a little time. And I hope that's early this summer, actually.
Good. Okay, now you've played great golf courses all around the world. Where would you rank Texarkana Country Club?
Way up there, the kind of the crown jewel of East Texas, and anybody that's played there raves about it, and it's special. And it's just a little gem, and you know, I have it way up there. It's a golf course that you'd never get tired of playing, and you know, the leadership in that club for lots and lots of years have just created a wonderful, not only a great golf course, but a great country club.
Well, when you come to town, I love TCC. It is one of a kind for sure. When you come to town, I want to get together with you. And so please let me know when you're going to be in Texarkana so we can sit down, maybe have a meal together. Bill, you've been a great guest, and I appreciate you so much. And thank you for your strong stand for the Lord. And I just pray God's blessings on you and your family. And thank you for being my guest today.
Oh, thank you, Jeff, and all the best to all everybody in Texarkana.
God bless you. Well, you've been listening to Real Truth for today, and I'm your host, Pastor Jeff Shreve, and that was Bill Rogers. Bill Rogers, a big-time PGA champion, the PGA 1981 Player of the Year, and we've been talking about the shocking news from the PGA, joining forces with the LIV Golf Tour, the Saudi-backed LIV Golf Tour. And it seems like the love of money has taken its toll once again. Well, when we come back, we'll take your calls at 888-589-8840. Don't go away. Welcome back to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. We're talking about have been talking about the PGA's shocking decision to merge with the Saudi-backed LIV Golf Tour. The Saudi-backed tour is also known as the Public Investment Fund. It's all the same thing, but it just seems to fit with 1 Timothy 6:10. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and have pierced themselves with many a pang. And so Bill Rogers had been my guest, and just a delightful guy, loves the Lord, and was on the tour till he was toward his late 30s, I think 37, when he walked away from the tour. He said he lost his fire for competitive golf. Still loves golf, still plays golf, but competitive golf is a different beast. And I marvel at the guys that can do that. Golf is such a hard game. And I tell people all the time, I love golf, but I'm terrible at golf. I just don't have the golf gene. But to be able to play at that level where you have to shoot under par pretty much every time you get out on the course to compete is a pretty daunting task. And golf is just so precise. It's not like other sports. It's not like being a defensive end, you know, in football. It's like you just go all out, sack the quarterback. Obviously there's skill involved with that. There's athleticism involved in that, but you don't have to grind it out in your mind to do that. And so I played basketball in high school, and basketball, you can get into a flow, you can react. And golf is not any reaction. It's everything that you do, you have to think it through, and you have to aim, and you have to make the swing, and lots of times it doesn't go in the place you want it to go. So hats off to Bill Rogers and all those who make their living playing golf. We had Zach Fisher on the program a couple of months ago, and I play golf with Zach's dad quite often, and Zach's uncle, Ronnie and Bobby Fisher. They're good friends. And so Zach is on the Korn Ferry Tour, trying to make it on the PGA Tour, and has done a tremendous job, but it's just a hard life. And sometimes we get the feeling that being a pro athlete is very glamorous. It's laden with temptation. You're away from home. You have downtime with nothing to do. I remember reading a story, the true life story of Josh Hamilton, the baseball player, and he had too much time on his hands. And you know, the idle hands are the devil's workshop, as the phrase goes. And so you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. You can start drinking. You can start taking drugs. You can get into all sorts of sexual immorality. And it can be a devastating life. Life on the road may look glamorous, but it is far from it. And it's so much better to go home every night and be with your family. So the love of money, the root of all sorts of evil. I think about the line from an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. It wasn't a very good movie. It was called The Last Stand. And how Arnold, he plays this sheriff in a small town, and he's trying to stop this drug cartel, and this guy's trying to get across the border, and Arnold is there to stop him and to take him to jail and bring him to justice. And they have this massive fight, and the guy says to him, he says, "Listen, all right, I'll pay you $20 million, $20 million just to look the other way." And Arnold says to him, "My honor is not for sale." I love that line. My honor is not for sale. Well, it seems that the PGA Tour, as they were espousing integrity and honesty and morality and shaming the guys who sold out their honor for these millions and millions of dollars, the numbers that they were offering these pro players was just insane. Phil Mickelson, $200 million to sign with LIV. Dennis Johnson, $150 million. Bryson DeChambeau, $125 million. Brooks Koepka, $100 million. Jack Nicklaus said they offered him $100 million to be the CEO of this LIV Golf Tour. Well, those guys said, "Okay, I'll do it. I'm doing it for the money." It's just, okay, so you're doing it for the money, but is your honor, is your integrity, what's that worth? That you can't put a price on that. And it's a sad day indeed when people sell out just for money. And, you know, we have this story in the Old Testament about Esau. He sold his birthright. And what did he sell it for? A bowl of stew. Now, one bowl of stew, you say, well, gosh, that's $5 for a bowl of stew. You sold something so valuable for $5. And Esau said, "Well, what is my birthright to me? I'm dying of hunger here. So fine, I'll sell it to you for the bowl of stew." Well, whether you sell it for one bowl of stew or whether you sell it for 200 million bowls of stew, you have to realize that your birthright, your honor, your integrity, who you are, is worth so much more than any amount of money. And we all need money to live, but the love of money, that opens up Pandora's box of evils. It's a root of all sorts of evil. I have maintained that in the medical community needs to be the bastion of truth and reality and science. And the medical community should obviously come out and say, when does life begin? Life begins at conception. It's a medical fact. It's a scientific fact. When the sperm and the egg come together and there's conception, that's when life begins. So therefore, to abort an unborn baby, you at any time during the pregnancy, that is murder, because that's a life. And when did that life begin? Life began at conception, and science backs that up. And the medical community ought to be the ones saying, yes, that's right. How about the issue of transgenderism? It's the medical community that ought to say, that is impossible. You cannot change your gender. You are either XY male or XX female, and that cannot be changed. Even Richard Dawkins, the atheist, he said, this is ridiculous, all this transgender stuff. He said that you can't change your gender. gender and sex are welded together, and they can't be separated. And you can think as an XY male that you're a female, but hey, reality says you're not. You can think that you're a 7'5" Chinese guy, but the reality is, you know, in that illustration, you're a 5'10" white guy. You can't just make this stuff up as you go. It has to be rooted in reality. But here we are. And why does the medical community not stand up and say, well, this is what it is? Well, it's the love of money. It's the pressure that gets put upon them. And money really controls so many people's actions. Well, I'd love to talk to you about this. 888-589-8840. That's 888-589-8840. If you'd like to weigh in on this discussion, this conversation, many people are in the United States, many people around the world, we love golf. And for those who play golf, you understand how hard it is to be a professional golfer. And you have great admiration for the guys that can do the things that these guys do week in and week out on the golf course, because golf is so hard. I use the illustration often when Debbie and I are doing a marriage conference. I'll say, you know, marriage is like golf. And here is how they're similar. Golf looks easy when you're watching it on TV. I mean, golf's not like other sports. The guys are typically not sweating. They're not running. They're not exerting themselves. They're not, dying of exhaustion. They look like they're dressed nice, and they're just kind of strolling along, and they just line things up, and they make one little swing, and the swing looks effortless from those guys. And you say, well, golf is easy. It's not easy. It's so hard. So then you go out there and you try and play and you find out this is really, really hard. How do these guys do this? It's hard to even connect with the ball, much less have it go the way you want it to go, much less have it go a long way off the tee. Well, marriage is like that too. Marriage looks easy from the outside. From the outside looking in, you say, oh, you know, well, love will keep us together, and all you need is love, and I'm in love with this other person, and we're going to be able to make this go, and we're not going to have any problems. And then you get married, and you find out how difficult it is to have a good marriage. I preached a sermon years ago, and I entitled it, Good Marriages Just Don't Happen. You have to work at them to make your marriage a success. Somebody said, what is marriage? It's like flies on a windowsill. Those are on the outside want to get in, and those on the inside want to get out. Marriage is tough, and your life is really forged, and your Christian life is so forged through marriage and family. Anybody can praise the Lord on Sunday morning in church. It's when you go home. That's where the rubber hits the road. And what are things going to be like at home? Isn't it interesting that when the Apostle Paul gives the qualifications for a pastor, he talks about the home life. He must be one, this overseer, this pastor that you're going to hire, he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. So that is the testing ground. How do you do at home? And sadly, lots of guys don't do very well at home. People in the Bible didn't do all that well at home. And home is the training ground. It's the place where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. So getting back to the issue of the love of money. Jesus, what did he have to say about it? I had mentioned this earlier when I was talking to Bill Rogers, but no one, Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, God and riches, God and wealth, God and money. And that really is the rival to the throne, so to speak. Because in our Christian lives, we have to serve the Lord. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you, Jesus said. But what is the rival that wants to be in charge? It's the love of money. It's letting money be in charge. And here's the thing. We all need money to live. And so because we need money to live, money can become the master and instead of the servant. Now, money is a wonderful servant. It's a terrible master. Jesus has to be the master. He has to be sitting on the throne of our lives. Money can't sit there. Solomon, who had more money than the Saudis ever dreamed of having, he said, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Money cannot satisfy the deep longings of a person's heart." Money can buy a lot of things, but it can't buy happiness. It can't buy love. It can't buy the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. You and I both know people that have a lot of money and they're very unhappy. I remember a quote that I ran across. I believe it was from Boris Becker, the tennis player, who had fame and fortune, and you know, he was so wildly popular a few decades ago on the tennis scene. And he made the statement that he understands now how people that are very successful and wealthy commit suicide. Just because you have money doesn't mean that you're going to be happy. As Pascal said, Blaise Pascal, the deep intellectual and scientist and mathematician, he said, "In every human heart, there is a God-shaped vacuum. And the only thing that can fill that vacuum," it's like a puzzle piece, "the only piece that goes in there that can fill that empty spot is the Lord Jesus Christ." As Augustine said, "Lord, you have made us for yourself, and we'll never find rest until we rest in you." Money can't fill that spot. Drugs and alcohol, they can't fill that spot. Success can't fill that spot. Only Jesus can fill that spot. So you cannot serve God and money. Now, how do you know if you're serving God or serving money? The way you know is by being anxious. And Matthew chapter 6 talks about, "Do not worry about what we shall eat or what we shall drink or what we shall clothe ourselves with. For God knows you need all these things. So just bring your needs to the Lord. Seek him first, trust him, and he will take care of you." Well, thank you for listening today to Real Truth for Today, and it is my joy to come to you every morning. I am Pastor Jeff Shreve, the pastor of First Baptist Church in Texarkana, Texas. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Hey, go out. Remember our two words: shine and share. Shine for Christ and share what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you, and God will use you as his witness. God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.